Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're going to continue our study in 1 Samuel. Today we're going to be in chapter 3, which kind of is the transition chapter between the priesthood involved in Eli and his family and a whole new setting, which is going to involve Samuel and his anointing of two kings and in the reign of the second one, a transfer from the relatives of Eli, which is Abathar, because he's going to go with one of David's sons in rebellion, Adonijah. And we're going to switch to the Zadokian priesthood. And really, this is a foreshadowing of that. Obviously, this was written after that had happened. And it seems like there is a lot of foreshadowing here, and a lot of things that's happening is not just the rise of Samuel, but this major transition from the period of the judges to the period of the monarchy, this transition from judges to prophets, and the transition from tabernacle at Shiloh under Eli to the tabernacle in Jerusalem under David and Zadok. And so all of this is happening at once. Have you ever thought how unusual it is? Instead of talking about the childhood of Saul or the childhood of David, we talk about the childhood of Samuel. Well, it shows what a major transition character he really was. He was a prophet. He was a judge. He was the anointer of kings. He was the deposer of kings. And I think we see something of his significance in the way it's his treatment that introduces Saul and David. As important as David was, Samuel had his own unique, extremely important place. Now, chapter 3 repeats a lot of what we know in chapters 1 and 2, and yet sets the stage for what follows. Let's look at it if we could. Now, the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord before Eli. Apparently, there were some things that Samuel needed to learn from Eli, some practical things, some things about the law, some things about procedures. And so he was learning that from Eli. And the word of the Lord was rare in those days. Now, the word rare means is a rather unusual word. It's usually translated, I think, precious in King James. Valuable may be a way of understanding that. The lack of the Word of God is most often used in the Bible as a rather metaphorical sense of the judgment of God on a person or a nation or a period. Let me give you some examples from other parts of the Bible. Psalms 74:9, Lamentations 2:9, Amos 8:11, and Micah 3:6-7. Notice it says, visions were infrequent. Now, what's the idea here about visions? Well, in verse 15, you'll notice that the communication of Yahweh to Samuel is called a vision. But if you look at verse 10, it seems so direct that it's not like he was dreaming, but it's a very objective communication, not a subjective dream or subconscious. But the Lord seemed to stand right before Samuel. And so I think we get the idea that many times in the Old Testament, these revelations are very objective. And I think they actually were audible in many times, visual many times. And so don't let the word vision mean like a trance. Now, Daniel received his vision in a trance. Others will receive it through dreams. But this was a very special kind of very precise, very objective revelation. let's see. Isn't it interesting here that God's going to bypass the established Levitical priesthood and go to a young boy, untrained, and who hasn't even been confronted by Yahweh yet? That shows the level of debauchery of this priesthood's family. And it happened at that time that Eli was lying down in his place. Now, his eyelids had begun to grow dim, and he could not see. That's verse 2. It's going to set the stage. Before I leave that word visions, I want to say literally it means, and no vision was spread abroad. And that means there was not the Word of God going out from these sanctuaries as there needed to be. The people were coming to meet God, but there was no Word of God going out. Now, why would it mention him that he has bad eyesight? Well, I think probably it's going to set the stage for us to understand that Samuel may have been called many nights to come help Eli, get a drink of water, help him to the bathroom, get something for him. Because he couldn't see. He couldn't see in broad daylight, couldn't see very well at night at all. Maybe it's setting the stage for why Samuel thought it was Eli that was calling to him. His eyes had begun to grow dim. We learn from chapter 2 and chapter 4, he was in his 90s. My goodness, it's understandable his eyes were growing dim. And the lamp of the Lord had not yet gone out in verse 3. What does that mean? Well, it's obvious from the passages in the Pentateuch that this menorah, which is simply the Hebrew word for lamp, was constructed in such a way that it had 7 bowls, or like lily petals, and they contained enough oil to last from sunset, which was the beginning of the day, to the beginning of the morning. And when they ran completely out, the light would go out and they had to be relit. So when it says they had not yet gone out, we're to understand it was still dark, but it was getting close to the dawn. It was early in the morning, okay? But not quite light yet. And Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. Now, there have been many discussions about this. Some say he was staying close to this menorah, which meant that he was not in the Holy of Holies, but in the holy place. Now, we learn about this lamp in Exodus 27, verses 20 and 21, and Leviticus 24, verses 1 through 4. Maybe Samuel was in there to do some kind of ritual duty, like make sure that lamp didn't go out, that wind didn't blow it out, or little mice get in and do something to it. It seems to imply, though, he was sleeping right next to the ark. The Jewish commentators have been so nervous about that. They were saying, well, he's just on a little room to the side where the priests live. This seems to imply that he was in this inner shrine and that Eli was outside in the vestibule some way. Now, that's where it says, and the Lord called to Samuel. Excuse me. Josephus says that he was 12 years old at this point, but there's no way of knowing that. I guess Josephus warned him 12 because at 13 he'd become responsible for the law. And here he sees he's a young man and God speaking to him at this young age was a sign of showing God's trust in him and Samuel's spirituality. And he said, here am I. That same thing as verse 16 is going to say. It's also the same as Isaiah chapter 6 verse 8 where Isaiah said to the Lord, here am I. It was a common response. It was a polite response, but a common one. And he ran to Eli and said, here am I, for you called me. And Eli said, I did not call you. Go and lie down. So he went and lay down. And the Lord again called, Samuel. So Samuel arose, went to Eli and said, here am I, for you called me. And he said, I did not call you, son. Go lie down. Now, if Eli would have been a more spiritually attuned man, I think he would have picked it up before the third time. Notice again, Eli, the Lord called again the third time, and he arose and went to Eli and said, here am I, for you called me. And Eli discerned that the Lord was calling the boy. And Eli said to Samuel, go and lie down, and it shall be if he calls you, you shall say, speak, Lord Yahweh, for thy servant is listening. So Samuel went and lay down in his place. And the Lord came and stood. Now, that's very interesting. That is usually used for the angel of the Lord. It's a very physical, anthropomorphic phrase. We're speaking about God as if he had a body. But really, God is spirit. The only person that takes this physical form in the Old Testament is not the Spirit of God or God. It's this angel of the Lord that in many passages seems to refer to God himself. Think of the burning bush in Exodus 3, where it says the angel of the Lord caused the bush to burn and then Elohim spoke out of the bush. There are many other times where it's obvious that, well, the three angels that came to Abraham's tent, two of them went to Sodom, and the other angel spoke as if he had the power to bargain for the fate of Sodom by forgiving their sins, if. And again, it's a physical representation of God. Many of us believe that when it's spoken like that, that it's the pre-incarnate Trinity. For the only person the Godhead to have a corporal existence is Jesus. And this may be a pre-incarnation revelation. Now, as came and stood and called, as at the other times, Samuel, Samuel, that's not unusual for this double repetition. Joshua is called twice, Moses is called twice, and here Samuel is called twice. Kind of an emphasis. And Samuel said, speak, for thy servant is listening. Now, why he left the word Yahweh out, I don't know, but he did. And the Lord said to Samuel, behold, I'm about to do a thing in Israel, at which the ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. Now, this is only used, I think, two other times precisely in the Bible, and both of them refer to the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple under Nebuchadnezzar II in 586. You find it in 2 Kings 21:12 and Jeremiah 19:3. Now, what was so shocking that God was about to do that could only be linked to something as shocking as the fall of the temple in Jerusalem? Well, it's referring, I think, to the judgment of God on the household of Levi and the sanctuary at Shiloh. We learn from archaeological evidence and from some allusions in the Bible that the Philistines seem to have destroyed this sanctuary completely about 1050 B.C., for the ark is not returned here. It doesn't come back here even after it's returned by the Philistines. And so it seems to be a total destruction. Matter of fact, it's interesting that in the book of Jeremiah, I believe it's in Jeremiah 7, that the allusion of this destruction in Shiloh is mentioned as a way of showing that God will judge even his own temple if his people get away from him. So something so revolutionary that can only be identified with the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem is this change of priesthood from Eli to Samuel. Now, Samuel may have been a priest, as we saw from a reference in Chronicles, but he was not the family of priests. They're going to change the family completely. We're going to change the location of the Ark of the Covenant. We're going to have the tabernacle, what's left of it, destroyed. And so it was a major kind of thing for the Jews to say, why would God allow this? And that's the reason this is made this way. Now, look at verse 12. In that day, I will carry out against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. Now, this is obviously a reference back to chapter 2, verses 27 through 36. It's an unnamed man of God that speaks to Eli, obviously a prophet. It's not Samuel, it's someone else. Isn't it interesting that God had people that he could speak through, meaning they were susceptible to God's voice, they were open to speak even to someone as powerful as the high priest, and not even named in the Bible. There are many great people like that. God knows them. God has them ready in every age and every place. What a wonderful man. I'm looking forward to meeting this man of God. I sure want to be one of those too, don't you? For I have told you that I'm about to judge his house. Now, of course, his house here is a kind of a play on the word. It means his lineage, but he's also going to judge the literal house where Eli ministered, the what was left of the tabernacle at Shiloh. Now, how much of the tabernacle is left? How many of the tents? I don't know. It seems to be a physical structure because it had doors, because it had doorposts, because it's called a house. So how much of the old tent and its frame and utensils are left? We just don't know. For I have told him that I am about to judge his house forever, which means a permanent cutting off his descendants, for the iniquity which he knew. Now, there's some real important things here about aspects of sin. Number one, it's not so much that he sinned, but he knew about the sin of his sons did. Now, notice it says, his sons brought a curse on themselves. Now, there are several ways in the Hebrew to understand this. You may want to get several English translations, particularly the Bible in 26 translations. Many times this reflexive form is not used, and it's sometimes said blasphemed God is another option here. I believe that's what the Septuagint has. But mine has cursed themselves. I like this reflexive translation, for I believe that truly men don't break God's laws. They break themselves on God's laws. Put it another way, I don't believe God sends anybody to hell. I believe men send themselves by their response to God's offer of salvation. And I think that's what's happening here. So it's the sins of the boys. But the daddy knew about it, and he did not rebuke them. Look at the end of verse 13. And because he did not rebuke them, he himself will be judged. It seems to be placed earlier, back in chapter 2, verse 29, that by not rebuking his sons, he was putting his sons before the Lord. So many times, it's not just sins that we do, it's sins that the sins of omission, that we know something is wrong and we don't act on it. We know something should be said and we don't say it. We know there should be someone spoken to and yet we don't speak, for whatever reason. And of course, Eli's whole house will answer for that. Therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever. Now this is a very unusual concept, yet a very true one in the Old Testament. The sacrificial system was basically for the sins of ignorance or the sins of passion or sins that polluted the whole area, like the death of somebody, didn't know who. The Day of Atonement was meant to kind of take care of those general sins that affected the whole community. The sacrificial system, spelled out so beautifully in the book of Leviticus, chapter 1 through 7, talked about three voluntary kind of sacrifices and two mandatory sacrifices that had to do with man's relationship with God based on the death of innocent animals. But the one thing that sometimes we forget is that the sacrificial system is based on unknown sin, which sin you don't know it is, or sins of passion or ignorance or accident. And by that I mean, if you knowingly sin against the Lord, there is no sacrifice for that sin. King James calls it the sin of the high hand. New American Standard calls it presumptuous sin. And what he's saying here is, you knew, Eli, your boys were doing evil and you didn't correct them. Those boys surely knew they were doing evil because they were perverting the worship of Yahweh into a Canaanite fertility cult and being very selfish with the sacrifices and impugning God by what they took from the sacrifice and when they took it. Now, what we have here then is this, you might as well see Numbers 15, 30 through and 31, that there was no sin available. Remember David, when in his sin with Bathsheba, that's described in Psalm 32 and 51, he says, "A broken and contrite heart is a sacrifice that you want to do away with, Lord," because there was no sin, no sacrifice that David could bring for the premeditated sin of adultery, murder, and cover-up. And here's the same problem here. And when it says forever, it simply means there'll be no atonement possible. No covering. It means to cover. You can't cover this sin. Atonement. Yom Kippur, the day of covering, the day of atonement. There'll be no covering for this in the death of innocent animals. Verse 15, new paragraph. So Samuel lay down until morning. Now, there's been some questions here. Does it mean he went back to sleep? I doubt that. Does it mean that he stood up when he saw the angel of the Lord standing or the vision of God? I don't know. Then he opened the doors of the house of the Lord. There have been two ways of looking at this. But the fact that the place had doors and it's called a house shows you there was more structure here than simply a tent of the wilderness. Some say that that was his regular morning job, that as he lived somewhere in the inner shrine, he was to open the doors. Now, what doors are these? Well, it kind of depends on where he's sleeping. Some say it's the outer doors to the holy place, but only the priests could go in there. Some say it's the outer doors, like the tent had a door for the people to come in, the outer thing. Some say that. We're not sure what that is. The other side is that some say that Eli was living in the vestibule, and by opening the door, Samuel was afraid he would have to confront Eli with this message of judgment, and the boy was reluctant to. Others say by opening these doors, he was trying to play like things were just like usual, and so he wouldn't have to confront Eli. I'm not sure, but it's obvious this is Samuel's first big test. Eli would not correct his own sons out of embarrassment or whatever, out of love maybe. Samuel's going to have to correct his older teacher in the priesthood. Samuel's going to have to confront someone he loved and liked, apparently. But Samuel's going to have to do it. It's kind of a test of his prophetic calling, and he will do it. Now, Eli's going to help him, but Samuel's going to do it. Eli called to Samuel and said, "Samuel, my son," notice that term of affection, and he said, "Here am I." And he said, "What is the word that he spoke to you? Please do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more if you hide anything from me of all the words that he spoke to you." Well, this is a curse formula, an oath formula. Some would say that there was a death of an animal involved. Some would say this oath is usually longer, had a curse with it, but Eli left off the curse. I don't know what the full thing was, but Samuel knew that in the strongest terms possible, Eli was saying, "Son, I want to know everything that God said to you. Don't you hide anything from me now. You tell me exactly what he said." This oath formula can be seen in several other places in the Bible. In 1 Samuel, you can see it in chapter 14, verse 44, chapter 20, verse 13, and chapter 25, verse 32. It can also be seen in Ruth, chapter 1, verse 17, which is also in the period of the Judges, as this first period of Samuel is. And then in 2 Samuel, chapter 3, verse 25, and 1 Kings, chapter 2, verse 23. And so Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. And he said, "It is the Lord. It is Yahweh. Let him do what seems good to him." I think Eli really did love the Lord. He recognized God's judgment. It was the second time he had heard it. Maybe it goes back to Deuteronomy 19 about two witnesses. They had two different delivery. It confirmed it from the man of God and from Samuel. I don't know about that. I just know that Eli recognized that the judgment was valid. You wonder why he didn't do something with his boys right then. Why he didn't discipline them right then. But he does it. He lets it rock on. Verse 19 down through 21 shows the rise of Samuel, how important he became, how God was with him, how he became to be known as a prophet in all of Israel. Let's look at it. And Samuel grew. This almost reminds me of the statement about Jesus, that he grew in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man. He continued to grow. He's a young boy. He's getting older through his teenage years. The Lord was with him and let none of his words fail. Now, you want to think that none of his words refers to God's words. And some translations, both ancient and modern, follow that. But in context, what's happening here is what the boy is speaking, and whatever he says, God is fulfilling. Now, this goes back to the qualifications of a prophet found in Deuteronomy 13, say verses 1 through 3, and Deuteronomy 18, verses 21 and 22. And so what God is doing is by his own Mosaic criteria confirming that Samuel is a true prophet of God. Now in chapter, you might want to see chapter 19. I'll hold that just for a minute until I get to the next verse. And all Israel from Dan to Beersheba. Now what is this? Well, as you know, back in Numbers 18, the tribe of Dan, which was located in the southern part, next to Simeon, next to Judah, right below Ephraim, close to Benjamin, but close to the Philistine area also, tried to move their tribal allocation. And they sent some representatives way up to the north, directly north of the Sea of Galilee, and they captured a Canaanite city. And that became the tribal allocation of Dan and the city of Dan. Now, what's so horrible about that, it's at the conclusion of Judges. And 18, 19, and 20, and 21 show you the terrible things that were happening during the period. It show the moral disintegration of the period. For a tribe to say, "I'm not going to stay where God gave me a lot. I'm not going to stay in my divine inheritance. I'm going to move because I got problems here, and I'm going to pick me a new place," is the height. Of presumption and unbelief to those Jewish people. But Dan to Beersheba came to be used as a way of saying from the farthest north of the Promised Land to the most southern limit of the Promised Land. Dan to Beersheba. Beersheba being in southern Judah, Dan being in the far north. It became an idiom. But the fact that this is put back in an early Judges period shows this book is written later, because this metaphor would not be in use for a long time, because Dan just moved to Judges 18. Knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet by the Lord. You might want to see chapter 19, verses 18 through 24, where he's also called a prophet. Now, the problem here is Daniel a prophet or is Daniel a judge? Now, he's called a judge in chapter 7, verse 15 through 17. He seems to be the last in the series of judges, but he's also the first of the prophets. Now, in chapter 19, verses 18 through 24, is where Samuel's leadership of what's known as the prophetic guild or prophetic group is discussed. And they were a pretty wild group. Saul went there and Saul took off his clothes and prophesied all day before the Lord naked. Well, that's a tough deal. These were pretty ecstatic prophets. Wild speech. Kind of bizarre activity. We're beginning to come into the prophetic movement. At first, it's going to be these wild groups. Then we transition through Elijah and Elisha. Later, we're going to have the prophets at the king's court. And that's not good either, because they're going to be paid by the king. We're going to have prophets who come from the country who weren't the king's prophet, like Amos and maybe Habakkuk or some of those other ones. Forgot what other prophet I was talking about. But anyway, not the king's prophets. So here we have the development of prophetic movement. And it's going to be highlighted by things like Isaiah, Amos, Hosea, those kind of prophets. Now, the prophetic movement gave balance to the law. The law said, do it this way, but the prophets are going to say why you need to do it the right way. So the prophets are going to focus on motive and righteousness and social and religious appropriateness. The law is going to focus on how and when and who and where, okay? And so I think he is a judge, but he's also a seer or a prophet. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh. Now, and this is just the opposite of how this chapter begins. But this chapter begins by saying the Lord did not appear to Shiloh. His word was rare. But now that a godly person's in place, the Lord's going to appear often. His word's going to go out from Shiloh. Now, the interesting thing here is that after this chapter, we don't hear much more about Shiloh. It's going to be destroyed. Apparently Samuel doesn't go there much anymore. He goes back to his home of Ramah. That's where he lives. That's where his ministry is. That's where he comes back to. That's where he's buried. We just don't hear a whole lot more about Shiloh from this on. Because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the words of the Lord. Now, I want to read to you a little addition here. It comes from the Septuagint, which is a longer translation of 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel. 1 Samuel's got some problems in the Hebrew text. We call the Masoretic text. Listen to this addition from verse 20 in the Septuagint. And Eli grew very old, and his sons continued to act more and more wickedly in the presence of the Lord. And, of course, they're going to be judged for that. So even in light of the judgment, Eli could not keep his sons in check or tried to cut them off from being priests. And the chapter is going to end. Our next study is going to be pretty long, chapters 4 through the first part of 7. So you may want to start reading that early. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.